This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Chuck Spahn, Sherwood, Wisconsin, USA, September 11, 2006. Sunshine Sketches of a Little Town by Stephen Leacock. Chapter 2. The Speculations of Jefferson Thorpe. It was not until the mining boom, at the time when everybody went simply crazy over the cobalt and porcupine mines of the new silver country near the Hudson Bay, that Jefferson Thorpe reached what you might call public importance in Mariposa. Of course, everybody knew Jeff and his little barber shop that stood just across the street from Smith's Hotel. Everybody knew him, and everybody got shaved there. From early morning, when the commercial travelers off the 6:30 express got shaved into the resemblance of human beings, there were always people going in and out of the barber shop. Mullins, the manager of the Exchange Bank, took his morning shave from Jeff as a form of resuscitation, with enough wet towels laid on his face to stew him, and with Jeff moving about in the steam, razor in hand, as grave as an operating surgeon. Then, as I think I said, Mr. Smith came in every morning, and there was a tremendous outpouring of Florida water and rums, essences and revivers and renovators, regardless of expense. What with Jeff's white coat and Mr. Smith's flowered waistcoat and the red geranium in the window and the Florida water and the double extract of hyacinth, the little shop seemed multicolored and luxurious enough for the annex of a sultan's harem. But what I mean is that, till the mining boom, Jefferson Thorpe never occupied a position of real prominence in Mariposa. You couldn't, for example, have compared him with a man like Golgotha Gingham, who, as undertaker, stood in direct relation to life and death, or to Trelawney, the postmaster, who drew money from the federal government of Canada and was regarded as virtually a member of the Dominion Cabinet. Everybody knew Jeff and liked him, but the odd thing was that till he made money, nobody took any stock in his ideas at all. It was only after he made the clean-up that they came to see what a splendid fellow he was. Level-headed, I think, was the term. Indeed, in the speech of Mariposa, the highest form of endowment was to have the head set on horizontally, as with a theodolite. As I say, it was when Jeff made money that they saw how gifted he was, and when he lost it. But still, there's no need to go into that. I believe it's something the same in other places, too. The barber shop, you will remember, stands across the street from Smith's Hotel and stares at it face to face. It is one of those wooden structures, I don't know whether you know them, with a false front that sticks up above its real height and gives it an air at once rectangular and imposing. It is a form of architecture much used in Mariposa, and understood to be in keeping with the pretentious and artificial character of modern business. There is a red, white, and blue post in front of the shop, and the shop itself has a large square window out of the proportion to its little flat face. Painted on the panes of the window is the remains of a legend that once spelt barber shop, executed with the flourish that prevailed in the golden age of sign painting in Mariposa. Through the window, you can see the geraniums in the window shelf, and behind them, Jeff Thorpe, with his little black skull cap on, and his spectacles drooped upon his nose as he bends forward in the absorption of shaving. As you open a door, it sets in violent agitation a coiled spring up above and a bell that almost rings. Inside, there are two shaving chairs of the heavier or electrocution pattern, with mirrors in front of them and pigeonholes with individual shaving mugs. There must be ever so many of them, 15 or 16. It is the current supposition of each of Jeff's customer that everyone else but himself uses a separate mug. One corner of the shop is partitioned off and bears the sign, Hot and Cold Baths, 50 cents. There has been no baths inside the partition for 20 years, only old newspapers and a mop. Still, it lends distinction somehow, as does the faded cardboard signs that hang against the mirror with the legends Turkish shampoo, 75 cents, and Roman massage, $1. They said commonly in Mariposa that Jeff made money out of the barber shop. He may have, and it may have been that turned his mind to investment. But it's hard to see how he could. A shave cost 5 cents, and a haircut 15, or the two if you liked, for a quarter. And at that, it is hard to see how he could make money, even when he had both chairs going and shaved first in one, then in the other. You see, in Mariposa, shaving isn't the hurried, perfunctory thing that it is in the city. A shave is looked upon as a form of physical pleasure and lasts anywhere from 25 minutes to 3/4 of an hour. In the morning hours, perhaps, there was a semblance of haste about it, but in the long quiet of the afternoon, as Jeff leaned forward towards the customer and talked to him in soft, confidential monotone, like a portrait painter, the razor would go slower and slower and pause and stop and move and pause again, till the shave died away into the mere drowse of conversation. At such hours, the Mariposa barber shop would become the very palace of slumber. And as you waited your turn in one of the wooden armchairs besides the wall, what with the quiet of the hour and the low drone of Jeff's conversation, the buzzing of the flies against the window pane, and the measured tick of the clock above the mirror, your head sank dreaming on your breast, and the Mariposa news packet rustled unheeded on the floor. It makes one drowsy just to think of it. The conversation, of course, was the real charm of the place. You see, Jefferson's forte, or specialty, was information. He could tell you more things within the compass of a half an hour's shave than you get in days of laborious research in an encyclopedia. Where he got it all, I don't know, but I'm inclined to think that came more or less out of the newspapers. In the city, people never read the newspapers. Not really, only little bits and scraps of them. But in Mariposa, it's different. There they read the whole thing from cover to cover, and they built up on it, in the course of years, a range of acquirements that would put a college president to blush. Anybody who has ever heard Henry Mullins or Peter Glover talk about the future of China will know just what I mean. And of course, the peculiarity of Jeff's conversation was that he could suit it to his man every time. He had a kind of divination about it. It was a certain kind of man that Jeff would size up sideways as he stropped his razor, and in whose ear he would whisper, "I see where St. Louis took 4 straight games off Chicago," and so hold him fascinated to the end. In the same way, he would say to Mr. Smith, "I see where it says that this flying squirrel run a dead heat for the king's plate." To a humble intellect like mine, he would explain in full the relation of the Kisar to the German rich dog. But first and foremost, Jeff's specialty in the way of conversation was finance and the money market, the huge fortunes that a man with the right kind of head could make. I've known Jefferson to pause in his shaving with the razor suspended in the air as long as 5 minutes while he described, with his eye half closed, exactly the kind of head a man needed in order to make a haul or a clean-up. It was evidently simply a matter of the head, and as far as one could judge, Jeff's own was the very type required. I don't know just at what time or how Jefferson first began his speculative enterprises. It was probably in him from the start. There is no doubt that the very idea of such things as traction stock and amalgamated asbestos went to his head, and whenever he spoke of Mr. Carnegie and Mr. Rockefeller, the yearning tone of his voice made it as soft as lathered soap. I suppose the most rudimentary form of his speculations was the hens. That was years ago. He kept them out at the back of his house, which itself stood up a grass plot behind and beyond the barber shop. And in the old days, Jeff would say, with a certain note of pride in his voice, that the woman had sold as many as 2 dozen eggs in a day to the summer visitors. But what with reading about amalgamated asbestos and consolidated copper and all that, the hens began to seem pretty small business. And, in any case, the idea of 2 dozen eggs at a cent apiece almost makes one blush. I suppose a good many of us have felt just as Jeff did about our poor little earnings. Anyway, I remember Jeff telling me one day that he could take the whole lot of the hens and sell them off and crack the money into Chicago wheat on margin and turn it over in 24 hours. He did it too. Only somehow, when it was turned over, it came upside down on top of the hens. After that, the hen house stood empty, and the woman had to throw away chicken feed every day at a dead loss of perhaps a shave and a half. But it made no difference to Jeff, for his mind floated away already on the possibility of what he called displacement mining in the Yukon. So you can understand that when the mining boom struck Mariposa, Jefferson Thorpe was in it right from the very start. Why, no wonder, it seemed like the finger of Providence. Here was this great silver country spread out to the north of us, where people had thought there was only wilderness, and right at our very doors. You could see, as I saw, the night express going north every evening. For all one knew, Rockefeller or Carnegie or anyone might be on it. Here was the wealth of Calcutta, as the Mariposa news packet put it, poured out at our very feet. So no wonder the town went wild. All day in the street you could hear men talking of veins and smelters and dips and deposits and faults. The town hummed with it like a geology class on examination day. And there were men about the hotels with mining outfits and theodolites and dunnage bags, and at Smith's Bar they would hand chunks of rock up and down, some of which would run as high as 10 drinks to the pound. The fever just caught the town and ran through it. Within a fortnight, they put a partition down Robertson's coal and wood office and opened the Mariposa Mining Exchange, and just about every man on the main street started buying scrip. Then, presently, young Fizzlechip, who had been teller in Mullen's Bank and that everybody had thought a worthless jackass before, came back from the cobalt country with a fortune and loafed around in the Mariposa house in English khaki and a horizontal hat, drunk all the time, and everybody holding him up as an example of what it was possible to do if you tried. They all went in. Jim Elliott mortgaged the inside of the drugstore and jammed it into Twin Tamagami. Pete Glover at the hardware store bought Nippawa stock at 13 cents and sold it to his brother at 17, and bought it back in less than a week at 19. They didn't care. They took a chance. Judge Pepperly put the rest of his wife's money into Temiskaming Common, and Lawyer McCartney got the fever too, and put every cent that his sister possessed into Tulip Preferred. And even when young Fizzlechip shot himself in the back room at the Mariposa house, Mr. Gingham buried him in the casket with silver handles, and it was felt that there was a Monte Carlo touch about the whole thing. They all went in, or all except Mr. Smith. You see, Mr. Smith had come down from there, and he knew all about rocks and mining and canoes and the North Country. He knew what it was to eat flour-baked dampers under the lee side of a canoe propped among the underbrush, and to drink the last drop of whiskey within 50 miles. Mr. Smith had mighty little use for the North, but what he did do was to buy up enough early potatoes to send 15 carload lots into Cobalt at a profit of $5 a bag. Mr. Smith, I say, hung back, but Jeff Thorpe was in the mining boom right from the start. He bought in on the Nippawa mine even before the interim prospectus was out. He took a block of 100 shares of Abitibi Development at 14 cents, and he and Johnson, the livery stable keeper next door, formed a syndicate that got 1,000 shares of Metagami Lake at 3¼ cents, and then unloaded them on one of the sausage men at Netley's butcher shop at a clear cent per cent advance. Jeff would open the little drawer below the mirror and the barber shop and show you all kinds and sorts of Cobalt Country Mining certificates. Blue ones, pink ones, green ones, with outlandish and fascinating names on them that ran clear from the Mattawa to the Hudson Bay. And right from the start, he was confident of winning. "There ain't no difficulty to it," he said. "There's lots of silver up there in that country, and if you buy some here and some there, you can't fail to come out somewhere. I don't say," he used to continue, with the scissors open and ready to cut, "that some of the greenhorns won't get bit. But if a feller knows the country and keeps his head level, he can't lose." Jefferson had looked at so many prospectuses and so many pictures of mines and pine trees and smelters that I think he'd forgotten that he'd never been to the country. Anyway, what's 200 miles? To an onlooker, it certainly didn't seem so simple. I never knew the meanness, the trickery of the mining business, the sheer obstinate determination of the bigger capitalists not to make money where they might, till I heard the accounts of Jeff's different mines. Take the case of the Corona Jewel. There was a good mine simply going to ruin for lack of common sense. "She ain't been developed," Jeff would say. "There's silver enough in her so you could dig it out with a shovel. She's full of it. But they just won't get at her and work her." Then he'd take a look at the pink and blue certificates of the Corona Jewel and slam the drawer on them in disgust. Worse than that was the Silent Pine, a clear case of stupid incompetence. Utter lack of engineering skill was all that was keeping the Silent Pine from making a fortune for its holders. "The only trouble with that mine," said Jeff, "is that they won't go deep enough. They follow the vein down to where it kind of thinned out, and then they quit. If they just go right into her good, they'd get it again. She's down there all right." But perhaps the meanest case of all was the Northern Star. That always seemed to me, every time I heard of it, a straight case for the criminal law. The thing was so evidently a conspiracy. "I bought her," said Jeff, "at 32, and she stayed right there, tight, like she was stuck. Then a bunch of the fellers in the city started to drive her down, and they got her pushed down to 24, and I held on to her, and they shoved her down to 21. This morning they've got her down to 16, but I don't mean to let go, no, sir. In another fortnight, they shoved her, the same unscrupulous crowd, down to 9 cents. And Jefferson still held on. They're working her down, he admitted, but I'm holding her. No conflict between vice and virtue was ever grimmer. She's at 6, said Jeff, but I've got her. They can't squeeze me. A few days after that, the same criminal gang had her down further than ever. They've got her down to 3 cents, said Jeff, but I'm with her. Yes, sir, they think that they can shove her clean off the market, but they can't do it. I've bought in Johnson's shares and a whole of Netley's, and I'll stay with her till she breaks."